Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Romy and Dan's High School Reunion Podcast.
Hello.
Brought to you by PB Electronics. Today, Romy, who do we have today?
We have actor Jeff Pearson. Hello, Jeff Pearson.
Hello, Romy. Hello.
Please, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Yes.
My pleasure.
Now, yes, we are so happy to have you here because you have had a very long and illustrious career.
I've had a very long career.
Which a lot of people would love.
Love. What's love? And you've been, God, how many TV shows have you been on? I mean, I've seen you in almost
100,
everything.
I don't know about
Yeah. And you've just, but you started, have you always been Los Angeles based or no East
no,
Coast? Because
no,
you did theater, right?
Yes. Yes. I came out here from New York in, I want to say 1994. I say to do a television pilot, it wasn't really a pilot. It was already bought. We did the pilot with the understanding that we were going to do 13 episodes because what happened was when they started this new network called the WB Network, which no longer exists, the guys who were running it, who had previously been at Fox, maybe 7 or 8 years earlier, they started Fox. And now they were starting this new network, which was a partnership between, I think, the Tribune Company and Warner Brothers, and there's, I think, one other entity involved. Anyway, they went to Ron Levitt, who had created Married with Children for Fox, and it was a big hit, and they wanted Ron to give him a series. So anyway, I got cast in that series, and so I came out to we were going to shoot 13 of them, which is what we did. And that show actually went on for 5 seasons.
How did you get that show? Did you audition for it?
It's funny. I was living in New York and I was doing a show that summer on ABC called Grace Under Fire. I was recurring on that show and I would fly out and do that show and then go back to New York and so forth. And so one of my trips when I was back in New York, I got this script and they put me on tape in New York for what turned out to be Ron's show, Ron Levitt, Unhappily Ever After it was called.
What was taping like back then?
Taping?
Yeah, putting on a tape. Like, it a self-tape or you went
into
the room?
I went to a place. They had a casting director in New York and they put me on tape. And so
self-taping didn't exist then.
I don't think so.
I remember Vincent D'Onofrio had to do a self-tape for Full Metal Jacket.
He did an audition tape.
Yeah. It was technically a self-tape. He had to hire a camera to put himself on tape.
Yeah, no, I believe
this
that.
Is back in the 70s.
Oh, I absolutely believe that. Yeah. No, this, they had somebody in New York that was putting people on tape. Yeah. But anyway, so then they said, well, they want to see you next time you're in L.A. And I said, well, I'm going to be in L.A., next week doing this other show. So that's how I got. Oddly enough, I had met Ron years before because Ed O'Neill was a good friend of mine, is still a good friend of mine. We had done a play together in Philadelphia in, I want to say, 1981, long before Married with Children or anything like that. But when Ed first was doing the show, he said, well, why don't you come to an episode of the show? So I met Ron that week. This is back in the, when the show first started. But I don't remember having any interaction with Ron. I was a guest actor in the one episode of the show. And I forgot about it, and I assume he forgot about it, but I don't know, maybe he didn't. But this was, many years later. This was maybe 7 years later.
Wow.
This other show came.
Yeah.
Because Married with Children went for, I think, 11 seasons on Fox. It was still in production when we did this WB show.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, that's how I got involved in it. And it was kind of unusual, to tell you the truth. There was a puppet involved, yeah. It later became that, Mark Wahlberg made a huge hit out of it with that one with the talking.
Ted.
Oh, yeah.
That became like
Al. Was it Alf in the 90s?
Alf? Yeah. Well, the conceit was that the puppet was supposed to be the character I played's alter ego, that the guy was so stressed out, he started talking to his little boy's doll, rabbit puppet.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a puppet, it was a doll. It was a, and that was the premise. But Bob Goldthwait played the voice of the puppet. And so
of course,
was already, zany puppet.
Yeah.
And we had this phenomenal puppeteer named Alan Troutman who would work with Henson and all these things. And the guy was fantastic. He barely brought that puppet to life every single week. But yeah, it was an odd concept. And no, it was an unusual casting because it was just a little unusual. I mean, I'm glad Ron gave me the opportunity to do it because it was such wacky comedy. I wasn't known at all, but I wasn't certainly known for comedy per se.
How did you find the change to into comedy?
I enjoyed comedy. You know, I had done, as you pointed out, I'd done a lot of theater. And in the 80s in New York, I was done a lot of soap operas. The main one I did was called Ryan's Hope. It was on ABC. I played Frank Ryan for 3 years on that show. But I, one time or another, I think I did about every soap opera that was in New York. that's what you did when you lived in New York.
Yeah, really?
And at that time,
this is actually very true. Yeah.
There was like, I think, six or seven of them. I think there's none now. But at that time, it was very common. One time or another, I worked with so many very prominent actors on daytime television. You know, from Jose Ferrer to Dominic Chinita, you name it. I mean, everybody you can think of. Because everybody in New York, that's how you made money.
Yeah.
Gigs.
That's exactly like how it is in Australia. We've got,
there you go.
You've got two shows. You've got Home and Away and Neighbours. We've only got two. But almost every single actor in Australia, if they live in Sydney, has been on Home and Away in one form or another because it's the only show that's continuously on. So people are like, oh, yeah, I'll get on that. I'll do that.
Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely. And completely understand.
Is General Hospital the only soap that's on?
No, General Hospital, Bold and the Beautiful, Young and the Restless.
But that's
I think those are the last three, and they're all in L.A.
Yes, they're all Los Angeles.
And I've auditioned for all of them.
Have you?
Yes.
Well, I was in...
And Days of Allies. Yes.
I was in New York, and that was... I mean, they had soap opera classes, and it was quite a... Yeah, it was... Everybody wanted
to be in
one.
It was a real cottage industry. It was more than a cottage industry. It was a big deal in New York in the 80s. And I think there was 14 soap operas at that time.
Sheesh.
On the air. It was a big, you know... It was like the B movie factory of the old Hollywood days, you know.
Yeah.
Do they?
And at one time or another, like I say, everybody pretty much was on them.
So do they not have the soap opera awards anymore because there's only three shows?
Good question.
I don't know. I'm not too sure.
Yeah. The daytime Emmys is that?
I think they do. They do have the daytime Emmys still,
right? Because it includes reality shows.
Oh. Yeah, shows, yeah,
talk
yeah.
Shows,
okay.
Yeah, shows. And I know a friend of mine's. Her friend just won a daytime Emmy last year or the year before. So, yeah.
Was there one that was specifically for soap operas? I think I'm confusing them.
The soapies? I don't know.
Maybe I just saw that on. Okay, so Robert Downey Jr., who I love, he was. He did a. Was it called Soap? He did a movie.
Yes, Soap Dish.
Soap Dish.
Soap Dish.
And it was so funny.
I think Carrie Fisher was in it as well.
Yes, I think so. But I think I got it from there. I think that they had like the Soap Opera Award. So maybe I'm just fantasizing.
They definitely had Soap Opera Awards. I don't believe I ever attended one. But yeah, they definitely, it was a big deal. You know?
So you went from doing Shakespeare.
And then the daytime. Yeah, it's funny because over the years how... distinct stages of the type of, you know, things I've done. Because like I said, I started out really doing theater and I did theater in New York and in a lot of regional theater as well in the Northeast and well, all over really. And then I got into daytime television. And then when that was over, I started doing comedies in the 90s. I did a lot of comedy because I did The Grace Under Fire and I did The Unhappily Ever After and I did several guest shots on other comedy shows. And then when the 90s ended, after 2000, I started doing all dramas again, mainly in television and very, very few comedies. So there's been, you know, like distinct things.
Did you notice anything like why that was?
I really couldn't figure out why it happened that way. I mean, it's just sort of, you know, you can have a plan. I'll never forget when I was first doing Grace Under Fire and the actress who played my mother on the show, a lovely woman named Betty Ray, she's no longer with us. She'd been on the Waltons and she had a very illustrious career. And I remember she said to me one time, may I give you a piece of advice? I think I was still coming out from New York to do these shows at the time. And I said, of course, Betty. And she pulls me aside. She says, stop doing television. And I knew what she was getting at, but.
What was she getting at?
what she was getting at was, you know, if you want to be in films, or you should be in films, then you have to stop doing television. Because from the background she came from, because she had worked at MGM in the 40s.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, she knew all the studio, you know, and the studio system was still working. And
well, that's old. Her idea now. Was,
yeah, no, that's old. I mean, obviously it's been over.
But people still joke 60s. About this, like at the award, at the Golden Globes. And I think even Jim Carrey said, because he was a film actor, but he was doing a TV show. But he goes, but I still have a front row seat. I get one of the front tables, you know, not with all the, or I don't remember what it was. He was part of a
skit. There used to be a bigger distinction between television actors and film actors. And
but
of course,
now,
so many great movie stars were television, and like James Garner and James Dean and Paul Newman. They all started out in live TV. Steve McQueen, you know, had his own TV show. A lot of these guys did, even those days. But
George Clooney
had a big TV show. Yeah, Tom Hanks had a sitcom. I mean, it's
Robin
actually
Williams.
Yeah, it's actually common nowadays.
Yeah,
in fact, the last 30 or 40 years.
Well, especially now that television's become very filmy.
Probably better than films nowadays.
Yeah,
I heard that from a CAA agent recently.
Yeah, that's very true.
He thought that film was dying and that TV was...
Yeah, I don't think he was referring to broadcast.
Like cinema.
He's referring mostly to the HBOs, the streaming, you know, all the stuff where there's...
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Not so much the restrictions of, you know, broadcast or network television.
I, you know, even as an actor, when I get an audition and, you know... we would love any job really at this stage, but it's always, if it's a cable show, like if I know it's for Stars or HBO, I get very excited.
Yeah,
if it's for ABC, and I hate to say this, sorry, ABC or CW, I'm just like, okay.
But then you book it and you're like, all right. Yeah.
No, you still want it, but it's because of those restrictions.
Yeah.
And I think as an actor, as an artist.
It's also the audience that they.
Yeah. You don't want the restrictions.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, when I was this show that just recently got canceled, it's still running on Netflix called
Designated Survivor.
That show was on ABC the first two seasons. Mm. And then ABC canceled it and then Netflix picked it up. And then it had one season on Netflix and then they canceled it a few months ago. So people would say, oh, now that it's on Netflix, I guess they can do whatever they want. You know, they can open up the stories and do all this. I said, I guess. Yeah. I mean,
and they did. They did, didn't they? Yeah. I remember somebody seeing it.
I haven't seen the whole.
I remember someone seeing it and I saw like really quite graphic things. They're like, whoa. Whoa.
You're right. I heard that too.
Yeah. They're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Where did this come from?
Never be on
that. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Whether that's good or, I mean, in some cases it can be good.
Yeah.
In other cases, maybe not so much.
They've got a built-in audience for that particular kind of vibe.
That's right.
This changes.
Because it's a whole different thing than it had been.
A whole different show.
You can prepare that audience.
I don't think most people like the censorship anymore and that restriction. I feel like audiences are so sophisticated in the way that they're, exposed to so much of what's happening in reality. And they kind of realize that network TV only doesn't really show the full reality, the violence and the graphics, all the edgy, dirty, dark stuff
of
life.
Yeah. I definitely think, network TV is definitely, I know what I'm going to get.
Yes.
So that's why I'm going to sit down and watch this because I know the procedural kind of a thing, or I know that's going to be, you know, the bad guy is going to be caught at the end and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
So I think it's one of those switch off kind of, kind of a things.
Yeah. But I mean, to answer your question or to speak to the question, in my case, it's just like, did I decide, well, now I'm going to do daytime. Now I'm going to go do theater. Now I'm going to do primetime. Now I'm going to do comedies. No. And
you just got the role.
It's just the role that came along. It's just really the opportunities that came along at the time.
Yeah.
I never thought of myself. I mean, I enjoyed doing comedy, but I never thought of myself as doing, you know, comedies.
Yeah.
Turned out I did a lot of them.
What do you prefer?
I'll tell you, I mean, a well-written comedy, in a really good show, can be very gratifying because, I mean, it's an entertainment medium, you know, you're entertaining people and you give them some enjoyment watching the show and watching the characters develop and how they act. I mean, I have no problem with that. You know, it's fine. I think what I started out doing, I mean, obviously I was thinking of more, dramatic type roles and I did a lot of those roles and continue to do them. But some people, I mean, I'm fortunate in that I've been able to go between comedy and drama. A lot of actors don't and can't. You know, they're just not adept at comedy, or they're very good comedians, but they're not. Although I must say, usually the reverse is the case. Usually people who are very good at comedy are good dramatic actors. I mean, when you think about Jackie Gleason or any of these people, you know, who are great comedians, but also extremely good dramatic actors. It's harder for dramatic actors, I think, to do comedy.
Yeah, because comedy is like this particular, very specific kind of muscle.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I did a film with Robin Williams, by the way, called World's Greatest Dad. That Bob Goldthwait directed.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was a very serious role that Robin did. I don't think there was any real comedy in it. Yeah. I mean, there was a little kind of banter between him and I. I played his boss, but it was very tongue-in-cheek, very, very subtle.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
And it was a very serious role, and I must say, I think it's one of the best things he ever did.
Yeah.
And I think most people who have seen the film would agree.
I believe I saw it a while ago.
He's the father of the boy who inadvertently kills himself.
Yeah, yeah. What was it like working with Robin?
Well, you know, it's funny. It was great. We shot it up in Seattle. Kind of be more than 10 years ago now. It was like 2006 or something like this. But anyway, and people would say, man, well, Robin Williams got to be careful. People would work with him or knew him. He says, you got to be careful because, you know, he's constantly making jokes when you're shooting and he's doing this and that. And to tell you the truth, I enjoyed it. And he was doing that.
Yeah.
He would be acting out right before they rolled cameras on a very serious scene. And I'm laughing and they got to compose yourself. But I actually enjoyed it.
You know? Yeah.
I thought it was great because he was funny. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's nothing like, you know, enjoying yourself.
You know what I really I thought was interesting about working with him those few weeks? That a few times I was able to engage him in just normal conversation. Mm. We were talking about our kids, schools, and college, and so forth. And I think he really appreciated that because a guy like that, he's got to be on all the time because he was expecting him to entertain.
Yeah.
And I think he needed some decompression where he didn't have to be entertaining, you know. And he was a very intelligent man, obviously, and very cordial, you know, kind of a thing. And I think he appreciated that, you know, where he could, like, relax for a minute, you know. Mm.
You bring up an interesting point because it's amazing. I just had this conversation with a friend of mine yesterday, and she says, I haven't seen you out much and around. And I said, yeah, because I'm really tired of being on all the time.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And I just need time to myself and to recharge. But how do you guys feel about that? It's really funny because it doesn't seem like it would take much energy to go out and be with friends, but you are. It's like
I'm a bit of a hermit, so
I was gonna say the same thing.
So I probably don't.
Me too.
But I have always had I have always been busy as a parent. So that's kind of takes up all my time when I'm not working, you know. And I don't want to say all my time, but I mean, I always have had that focus because since I was 21 years old, so I still do.
Yeah.
Because I still have teenage children. So,
how old are they?
They're 18 and 16.
Uh-oh.
18 and 16. Yeah. One's a senior and one's a sophomore.
Yeah. And what do they think of dad's career?
Gosh, that's a good question. We don't talk about it very much.
I guess this is what dad does.
I mainly talk about, you know, what they're doing, obviously.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's my focus. But then I have three grown children in their 40s. So, one of them lives in LA, one's in New York, and one's in Pittsburgh. So they're kind of spread out. But,
Are any of them in the entertainment industry?
No, not really.
And you're like, thank God.
Yeah.
They dodged a bullet with that one. No, one of my sons did write a few plays. I think he had three of them produced.
That's good.
Oh, wow.
Good, but he got out of that. And then one of my daughters, for a while, worked as a writer in television, and she did some like children's television and animated stuff, and then she got out of that and got more into the journalism side, which she worked for corporations, and now she's writing a novel. Actually, I think it's going to be published, but she has a career as a writer, but not necessarily in show business.
Yeah,
but she dabbled in it for a while.
But they've all got like artistic kind of
my daughter in high school is quite an artist. She's a painter, and then that's cool. My son is on a football team, so you know maybe.
What's his position?
He's a wide receiver.
He's got a bit of speed.
Notre Dame JV.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Got a bit of speed about him.
Yeah.
You were on one of my favorite TV shows, by the way, called Boardwalk Empire.
Yes.
Oh, my God. I love that show so much. I never wanted that to end.
I'll tell you, that show started out with such great promise for so many reasons, obviously, because the people involved in it, the amount of money that HBO spent on it.
And this was like early days of HBO becoming.
I mean,
becoming what it like super was.
Well, I'll tell you what it was.
Like, I know there was a period with like, you know, Sopranos and all that sort of stuff, like around that.
This was later.
No, I know that. Yeah, but I'm just saying.
Immediately followed.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like,
and I really think that the intention was that this one was going to take the place of the Sopranos.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was going to be the next big HBO thing. I'm not sure if it quite worked out that way, and I'm not sure of all the reasons why. I do know, I remember talking to one of the producers the very first season and saying that what a fantastic, and I'd read the book and I said, what a fantastic idea this is. And the idea was it was going to go from Prohibition, 1919, to the stock market crash in 1929. It would cover that period. This is fantastic. Practically every luminary from the 20th century, early
get to wear awesome clothes,
came through there, you know, one time or another. You know, from Babe Ruth to, you know, to Joseph P. Kennedy, you name it.
Yeah.
And then later they did have Joseph Kennedy character in the thing.
That's right.
But it was a difficult task they took on because, for example, the character I played was a real person. He was actually the governor of New Jersey. He was a senator from New Jersey. He was an ambassador to Europe. He died of natural causes in the 1950s. He was not a gangster. He was not a, you know, rum runner. He was, you know, he was a politician.
Mm.
And the part that Steve Buscemi played, the central role, was also a politician. He was the commissioner of Atlantic County, New Jersey. I'm the real guy.
Yeah.
Well, they changed the name so they could fictionalize the character. And then they added, they didn't just have Al Capone and Bugs Moran and so forth, actual, you know, gangsters and bootleggers. They mixed in fictional characters. Okay. I mean, that's a difficult thing. You got to be careful when you do that, you know, because you're having a real character talking to a fictional character, you know?
Yeah. And then people can kind of like go, eh, that didn't happen.
That didn't
happen.
Going
on? Yeah. Especially today.
I know that story you're alluding to, and that's not the way it went down. Yeah. You know, that kind of, you know.
You just have to go, hey, this is artistic license, guys. That's right. This is what we're doing.
That's right.
When you walked on set, was it like stepping into a different world? Because people,
really was.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
It was gorgeous.
And they built a boardwalk on the East River.
That's so awesome.
In Greenpoint. I mean, it was obviously they CGI'd it to make it look, you know, more like Atlantic City boardwalk, but in an actual several hundred feet boardwalk.
Yeah.
Which was fantastic. And just all the locations where they shot it were interesting. But yeah, it started out, what a great idea for so many reasons.
But didn't the show do well? I mean, I thought it was doing quite well.
I think it went about 4.5 seasons.
Four and a half?
I think so.
Yeah. So they didn't get.
Sopranos, I think, went 9.
Yeah, yeah. So it didn't get to the part where they wanted it to get to.
I'm not sure why.
You don't know?
No.
Was the viewership down? Because I think it would have had a pretty good built-in audience by that time.
I've done several shows, you know, for HBO. I the last one I did was literally a quote-unquote can't miss because we had a phenomenal cast. Mm. We had phenomenal producers. We had, you know, great technical support. We had everything. And it lasted one season.
What was the show?
It was called The Brink.
Oh yes.
Oh, with was that Jack Black?
Jack Black was in it.
That
Tim
was
Robbins
funny.
Was in it.
That was funny.
Asif Manvi was in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Pablo Schreiber. Am I thinking of the right one?
Pablo Schreiber, Pablo Schreiber was in it, and then his partner in it. Eric, begins with
that. I know who you're talking about.
He was hilarious in it. We had great guest stars. We had Jerry Weintraub was the executive producer.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good friend of mine.
Jerry?
Yes, very good friend.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I miss him very much.
Yes.
He's a mentor.
Yes. Oh, fantastic. Yeah. I didn't know that. That's
yeah, great. I still have.
I only got to know him that one year we worked. And then, of course, what happened was we had a big premiere after the first season. And that's the last time I saw Jerry. And I went up to congratulate him, and he thanked me, and he said he was so happy. He was so happy. This was his baby. He's the guy that found it, brought it to HBO. And then 3 weeks later, he was dead. And then they dragged their feet. Then they finally renewed it after a couple of extensions. Mm. And then they canceled it after they renewed it. So we only did the one season. We made 10 episodes. And I've talked to Tim Robbins about it since then as to why they decided.
He was so good in it.
Oh, my God.
Tim Robbins was so good in it.
Tim was hilarious in it. Jack, of course, was hilarious.
Yeah.
And Jack could say, when are we going to work together? Because, you know, I was in D.C. I was the Secretary of Defense. Tim was the Secretary of State. And Jack was this low-level State Department guy over in Pakistan.
Yeah.
So I said, well, we're going to work together when I come to Pakistan or you come to D.C.
Do you know? Okay, so this was the show. I was supposed to be on that show. Mm-hmm. It was a guest star part because Jerry kept on talking about it.
Yes, and Jerry, he would have been on it.
I'm bringing you in. And not going to say, but there was a part I was supposed to get and he didn't realize what the part was. I'm not going to say what it is, but then.
Oh, wait a minute. Was the part with the girl in the hotel with Tim?
Yes.
That part?
And he pulled me from it. Yeah. And he goes, you're not doing
this. No, not that part. No,
yeah.
No. He had another part in mind.
Yeah. And he goes, I'll get you on it later.
Yes.
And, but this was the show. Okay. It's funny that you knew.
Yes, I know. There's only 10 episodes. I saw 10 of them, you know, so. But just goes to show you. I mean,
you just
how
don't
can
know.
You miss?
And yeah.
We had a famous, why am I drawing a blank on his name? Our director. He had done all the Austin Powers movies. And
is it Jay Roach?
Jay Roach,
yes.
Thank you. I don't know why. I mean, Jay's a lovely man.
Yeah.
Did a great job. But anyway, you never know.
Wow,
you
man.
Never know.
That, like, I really enjoyed that show. Like, yeah, I really enjoyed it because I remember, like, I saw it and I was like, oh, this looks kind of funny. And then I watched the pilot and I was like, oh my God, this is awesome.
So
like,
people came
Tim Robbins was fucking hilarious.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
I really was hoping, and they did. They, like I said, they picked it up and then they just said, you know what? No.
Yeah.
And then they changed the head of programming.
At
HBO. I think Michael Lombardi got replaced by somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was Jerry's baby, as you know.
Yeah. He had talked about it for a very long time,
you know what?
The whole thing, like in development.
And had Jerry lived, I'm almost positive they would have done at least a second season to see where these writers could take it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm
and
positive.
And if they still thought
they would have.
It was, you know, it wasn't working, fine. They would have canceled. But I don't think they would have canceled while Jerry was alive.
Mm.
I really don't.
He really had an eye for and a nose for things.
And he knew. And he went back to the founding of HBO. I mean, Jerry knew where all the bodies were buried. I mean, you know, he was.
He knew where everybody's body was
that's
buried.
That's right. I mean,
what did he say to me once? He said the same thing to Matt Damon, but he said, I wanted something, and I'm going to tell you what I needed or wanted.
Yeah.
And he says, there's always a guy.
Always a guy.
And I was like, and you know them. And this is a funny story. He was in London shooting something and I had just torn all the ligaments in my left foot. And the doctor.
How'd you do that?
Irish step dancing. Oh, you know. Okay. So, but I was in so much pain and the doctor had given me Vicodin. Mm-hmm. And which I, by the way, I'm so dumb and stupid on drugs. I did not know that this was an addictive drug. I just thought, well, the doctor gave it to me. That's how stupid.
It'll be fine. Yeah.
Yeah. And then after that prescription ran out, after a week, and by the way, I loved it so much. I kept on like having the Vicodin pills towards the end and then quartering them. I was like,
oh, so it wouldn't run out.
So it wouldn't run out.
Oh, man.
And so finally I went back to the doctor and I said, you know, can I get another prescription of Vicodin? And, he says, no, you're on ibuprofen now, which was very smart of him. Wise of him. Good doctor.
Yes.
But, I messaged Jerry. And I knew he was in London. And I said, hey, can you get me some Vicodin?
Of course you could.
I get a phone call. It must have been, you know, not more than an hour had gone by. And he really said, he goes, are you hooked on Vicodin? He goes, do you need help? He thought I was an addict. And I said, no. And I explained to him the story that, no,
yes.
And he didn't quite
believe
me. His
first instinct was to make sure there was no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was still so baffled. And I was like, no. He goes, people die from that shit.
Yeah.
And in fact, while you keep on talking, I want to show you guys something. So keep on talking.
I want to keep talking about The Brink. How was the experience? Like,
well, I'll tell you, it was it could be difficult because we had to shoot a lot of it in the, I don't want to say the war room, but the, whatever they call that room wasn't the war room, but it could be, we had long days.
I've got that book.
Oh, I've read that book. Yeah, I have
yeah,
book
I've got that book as well.
Oh, he, what, did he write something to you?
He did.
Yeah.
Can you read that out?
All right, so
dear and great friend, the only woman I would watch with a hula hoop.
That's so true.
That's cute.
So what are we looking at here?
So he's seen you with a
I'm a hula hoop dancer.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
And then I, you know, I was doing like, you know, shows in the circus, and I said, hey, can I, you know, show you routine? And he goes, oh my God, you're so good. And he goes, you remind me of somebody, I guess, back in the 70s or 60s, whatever, who was also a hula hoop dancer. And so he gave me this book. And it's very a phenomenal book,
very
by
entertaining
the way.
Book. Yeah, yeah, I've read it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I just remember he, you know, he was, wait, let me write something in it first. And the sad thing was that I, of course, you know, didn't, it was a friend who told me he had passed away. And it was the next day because I think it was all over the air and I was devastated.
But yeah, I mean, you would have definitely been on the show had it got a second year. I have no doubt of that. I have no doubt of that. It's just that there wasn't enough time. You know, it just ended too soon.
I will say there's somebody, and this is when I started to dabble in producing, and he really did believe in me. And, you know, as an actor, and he used to say, you know, he goes, you've got beauty. He goes, but you've got brains. And I said, well, which is more important, this talent? He goes, he had to think.
Yeah, let me think.
And he goes, both equally.
Yeah.
And when I asked him about producing, I said, what's the first thing you can teach me about producing? He goes, never use your own money. That's all he said.
But there's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah. I've heard that from various people as well. Mm-hmm. Like, do not use your own money for things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it pays off, like Kevin Smith, for example, you know.
Elon Musk.
Yeah, he's doing okay.
Elon Musk is doing all right.
Money.
Yes.
Oh, he came from a wealthy family? Is that right?
No, he had, I want to say that he did, he was already, he didn't come for money, but he was already doing something and he made money from an investment.
Right. Yeah.
And then there was a new opportunity, and that's when he put his own money in it, and he believed it so much. Right. And then, of course, that exploded.
Yeah.
And so I think he just smelled the success there, and it was just, I can't.
He created PayPal, didn't he?
Yes.
He just had win after win.
He's
just, but he's also, if you've seen like interviews with him, he's just on another level.
He wouldn't wish
what goes on in his mind on other people.
Yeah.
Because it's just constant.
Yeah.
All that sort of stuff. It's really interesting.
No, it really is. I mean, a guy's a certifiable genius, that's for sure.
Yeah, and sometimes those geniuses, they really bring on insanity.
Well, he may be better as a consultant to that company rather than trying to actually run it. Hire somebody who can actually run it.
No, that's true.
But the ideas that must go, really, these super smart people, my mind doesn't stop and I'm not a genius by any stretch of the imagination, but even I have trouble sleeping because my mind doesn't shut off. And I said, why can't I just turn my mind off?
Can't do it. There's not much you can do about adjusting, you know, your own personality, and you just got to sort of play the hand you were dealt. It's like, you know.
You'll be fine, Ruby. You'll be fine.
It's such a burden to be so smart. No, I'm just kidding. No, but it is.
So stressful.
Yeah. No, it's a burden to have a type A personality, OCD personality. Yes. That's what I'm talking about. Because it has stopped me from definitely wanting to do other things. Like I'll be late going to something and I'll be like, no, but I have to, you know, wash the dishes first, or I have to like clean them.
I said, I don't have that problem.
Yeah, or something. And I know because I cannot relax if I know I'm out. I'll be thinking about those dirty dishes the entire time.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be a bit of a handicap, isn't it?
Oh, it's awful. So now I'll just wash it immediately after I use it.
Fair enough.
I don't even.
We'll just use like plastic everything and just boom, throw it away. See,
well, I want to be good to,
one bowl, one cup,
to the,
one the environment.
Be good to the environment.
Yes, no, that's fair enough. That's fair enough.
Did you ever see the show Monk on USA?
Yes.
the role that Tony,
yeah,
Tony plays.
Okay, yeah, I'm not that bad. Not quite.
there. You're not solving crimes or anything like that?
Oh, I wish I could. Actually, that I wish I could
that
do.
That would be kind of cool.
I think that would be like my alter ego would be a Sherlock type of character, solving crimes, solving mysteries. And actually, I always said if I didn't go to drama school, I would have gone to school for forensic pathology.
Really?
I love, and I have a fascination with corpses.
Yeah, really?
And wanted to go to
medical examiner.
Yeah, and wanted to go to autopsies. And so my friend was in England. He was English. He was an anesthetist, an anesthesiologist, but they called it anesthetist. And so he was telling me about how somebody, a man, had just come in. And I said, can I come? Can I see?
No.
And he said, and he just happened to be there because he was the first on the scene. It was an accident. And he just happened to be a doctor. And he goes, no, it's not one of those you want to see because he was decapitated.
But you wanted to see that?
No, I did not want to see that. Okay. But what interested me was this. I did actually say, what was the look on his face?
Oh.
And he goes, it was a look of surprise.
Surprise, yes.
As if he knew something was coming at him, but didn't have time to, of course, and then it just hit him.
Mm-hmm. That's just crazy.
And so it was just marked on his face as surprise. So things like that really fascinate me.
Yeah. Hmm. Apparently Alan Ball, too, because of that series he had 6 Feet Under.
Oh, yeah. Well, that makes sense.
You know, funeral.
Yeah, program. Why is that? Am I disturbed?
No. Well, I think humans have a morbid curiosity anyway. Like back in the gladiator days, people loved watching two people kill each other.
Yeah.
People love UFC.
And literally.
Yeah.
Kill each other.
Yeah.
People used to go to hangings.
Yeah. Right? Like all that sort of stuff.
Are you going to the hanging today?
Yeah.
Drawn and quartered.
That used to be entertainment.
Yeah,
people.
The crowds would come out for that. Can you imagine?
You're just normal, Romy. You're just wrong. Very normal.
I did a television series called Dexter on Showtime.
That's right.
Michael Hall.
That little show.
Yeah, that little show. And Michael, you know, when I first, the first season, I kept calling him his name from 6 Feet Under.
Yeah. Oh, really?
What was his name? I'm just trying to think. Because he was so identified in that part. And
one of the producers and writer, Lauren Gussis, on the show,
yes.
Dexter,
yes.
Her husband is also a writer, and he's coming to podcast with us tomorrow. So it's interesting.
Great. He's a writer, a television writer?
David Fisher.
David. Yeah, yes. I'm calling him David.
Yeah.
No, it's Michael. And his name in the show was Dexter. Dexter, whatever his last name.
Yeah.
But no, Mike is not a television. He does mostly film. He wrote a very small film called The Wedding Planner with Jennifer Lopez.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite films. Yeah. But I've actually known him for a while. But I've met Lauren. And so she was so great. She met me one time and she called me into audition for Dexter.
Oh, really?
But I was horrible. It was at...
Was it for someone who was going to get killed? No.
No.
He only killed bad people.
Yeah. It was actually a nice sized part. I think it must have been a guest star. It was just a guest star part. Mm-hmm. But that was one of the times I just didn't audition well.
Yeah.
Because you have to be a good auditioner. You can be... I've met some... You know, I'm also an acting coach and some of my students, I mean, they're so talented and I'll say, oh my God, you're so good. But on camera, they don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And because they've had so much scene study, but not enough on camera work. So it's just tweaking them. So it was that tweak. I didn't have someone like me tweaking me like that very specifically. And so I think I was just all over the place and I knew it. So I knew I was going to do a bad job and I psyched myself out.
Yeah. Oh, you can do that. You can do that very easily. I mean, it's a strange kind of alchemy that happens when you think about it, the whole casting process and how a person, you know, gets right for a certain role. I had a little insight into it because when I was doing the sitcom in the 90s, I directed several episodes. And so I'd be there for casting. And it's amazing how you almost immediately know who's the right person for the part.
Yeah.
You think, well, any number of people could do this part, which they could. But it's funny when you sit in cast and you almost immediately know that's the person I want for the part.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Is it an essence thing? That person's essence?
Yeah.
Or it's not just about
sometimes
skill.
People will come in who are obviously wrong or, you know, they're inept at reading. But most people are, you know, pretty, you know, fluent in doing it. But you just have a sense that that's the right person for the role.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing.
But has anyone ever come in and they were they're not right for the, they're not what you're looking for, but they're so good.
I'm sure that happens all the time.
You're like,
you know, not so much in the roles that I was sitting in on, because they were, you know, guest stars in sitcom, you know, episodes. So it's not like big major. They're like, just got someone's coming. He's going to be the delivery boy, or he's going to be the, you know, girlfriend for that episode, whatever it may be.
I remember hearing a story from a friend of mine, Stephen DeKnight, who created Spartacus. He was, they were casting Daredevil on Netflix, and the character is supposed to be, is blind and a lawyer who's a superhero. He's Daredevil. And so the guy who ended up getting it came in, and his idea was, okay, this guy is blind and he's got really powerful, like, you know, senses and stuff like that. So everything would be intense for him. So he did the entire scene kind of very small and kind of like, oh, you know, all that. And everybody in casting was like, whoa, that was like completely the wrong choice. But we absolutely loved the fact that he did that.
Yeah.
And they brought him in again and gave him some direction. He ended up booking it.
Right.
But it was somebody who, his choice was not right for what it was, but because they just loved the fact that he did something so different why they brought him back and then gave him a little tweak. And then when you watch his performance, it's still actually kind of in there, the very kind of
small intensity
and stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, there's some, you know, famous, successful actors who they say were very terrible auditioners, but there was, it's like you're saying.
Yeah.
They noticed something, a quality about it. They say that about De Niro.
Yeah.
That he wasn't, like, couldn't audition.
Really?
Somebody noticed something about him, and maybe Scorsese, and put him in the main streets or whatever.
I've told this story on a previous podcast. Sean Penn, I think it was for Dazed and Confused. They were like, no, this guy's amazing. He's really, really good. He just gets super nervous. And so he went into the room, and they were like, what are you like, this guy's terrible. What? And they were like, no, please. And they did a self-tape and sent it in. And then casting was like, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then, you know.
How are you at in the early days of auditioning?
Oh.
Were you always comfortable?
Well, I think you always get a little nervous beforehand. I never got frozen up with nerves. You know, I can't recall too many instances where I really thought, well, I blew that because of the audition. I always thought, well, that either went okay or that was about what I had in mind.
Yeah.
I could generally do it kind of like, well, that was about what I had in mind. And if I did worse than that, I felt like, well, you know, so be it. You know what I mean? I remember one time testing for a soap opera. And I remember, and for some reason, they had a monitor where you could see the other guys testing.
Oh,
and
no.
I thought to myself, if I don't get this job, I'm going to get out of this business. I said, these guys. And I didn't get it. And I thought, well.
I did a network test for, I think it was Young and the Restless. And the way they did it, I don't think we were on camera. We had to do it as though it was theater.
Mm-hmm.
So you had all the executives on the seats in the room, and they just said, okay, just face out kind of, you know, while you're doing the scene to the other actor. And that was very interesting. I was lucky because I was like, oh, I've done plenty of theater before. Fine. This is cool. You just turn yourself out. It may feel a little foreign, a little weird initially, but, you know, it was all fun. Didn't book it, but.
I was thinking it'd be kind of funny if in auditions they had that mirror like they do in police stations.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And then you wouldn't see anybody sitting there.
Yeah. How much easier would that be?
Well, the most.
It'd be interesting.
The most nerve-wracking ones are when you test for television shows, because then they have to do the network test and you have to do the studio test. And sometimes it's a gauntlet you have to run.
Yeah.
You know, maybe 40 or 50 people sitting in a room. And it's like you said, you're not on film. You're doing it as a stage.
I mean, is that a necessity? Isn't that overkill? Having all these people,
it does seem that way, to do it over and over again.
Like, I've known people who have network tested for things, and they come in, they do it, and they just kind of leave going, what? Like, this one time, they did the network test, but the people were in another room watching it through a monitor. And it's kind of like, what was the point of that? If we're coming in for this audition in front of, for all these people who are just going to be watching it something on tape anyway, why don't I just hand in the self-tape that I did in the very beginning that got me to this level?
Yeah.
I just had that experience, and it was a question that I actually had to call Tim. I mentioned Tim Decay earlier, that I had to ask him about. It was a callback, but the callback was from a self tape. And I asked my manager, and I go, well, they already have me on tape. Why do I have to go in? They don't want to go in the room. And she goes, well, they want to see you again in person. And I was like, shit.
Yeah,
I called Tim and I said, why would they want to see me? I go, the callback. I go, they already, and I was bitching. I should have been grateful, but it was nerves. It's like, I don't want to, oh my God. It's like, you can control a self-tape situation. You can fuck up 100 times, but, and then have a great take. I mean, actually, Dan, you know, it's like 1 or 2 takes. And I was like, we're done.
Yeah, let's go. There's a memo.
Yeah, that's pretty much. I said, it'll be really quick.
Yeah.
So he doesn't mind self-taping me because he knows it's not going to take an hour, 5 minutes. But they call me back in and I asked him, and I go, so why would they want to see me again, Tim? And he goes, probably because they want to even the odds. And they just want to see everybody in the same lighting with the same kind of, pressure. And the same background, same camera. Everything, same sound quality.
Yeah.
He goes, they're leveling the playing field.
Yeah, and it's the system too, right? I mean, it's the system that's in place.
The system sucks.
For decades. You know?
Yeah. I mean,
let's break the system.
The funny thing
folks.
Is, you get to know very often when you're testing, they whittle it down to like 2 or 3 or 4 guys. And so you're all sitting there together, you're spending the afternoon.
Hey. Hey.
And sometimes you're thinking, wait a minute, these guys are nothing like me. Why are we testing for the same role? You know?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not. But
actually, I felt that in that particular audition because. Admittedly, I was the only non-famous person in the room, and there were about 4 of us, and I immediately got threatened. I forgot all of my lines, and then I thought to myself, logically, maybe one of them has already been offered the part. They're namey actors.
No, they wouldn't be there.
Yeah, but everything, but I'd forgotten all my lines. I forgot my own name. Yeah. And it was that kind of thing where I said, what am I doing here amongst these other people that I've looked up to? Some of them actually were much older than me. Yeah. And I said, I've looked up to these people. They're the reasons why I started acting.
Yes.
And you just talk yourself down. And I almost call my manager to say I need a pep talk or something because I had drilled those lines and I couldn't remember a single one. Yeah. And I really did have to. And I did fine in the end because it was so embedded.
It's
all
a barbaric. It's a barbaric.
It
was horrible.
Yeah. I had this audition for a CW show called iZombie. The first audition was with like 4 or 5 of the producers and the casting. And I wowed them. They were all laughing and they thought it was fantastic. I left there kind of going, that was fantastic. And then I got a call back. I got a call back to casting, but it was the casting assistant in the room, like reading the lines plus moving the camera as well.
They went in reverse on that.
I was like, what was the point of this?
Yeah.
Like,
what was the point of that?
I don't know. I didn't get it. But I just kind of was like, I don't understand this. What different? There was nothing different that they wanted from me for this audition.
Yeah.
Like, especially when, you know, it's
that
reversed.
Sounds like a mistake in scheduling. They did a flip. They did the reverse.
Actually, it's fun you mentioned that because it just triggered a memory. It's just a reason. It's not my memory. It was one of my students who had called back from a self-tape. And it was the same experience is that it was the callback and it was for something quite big. And she didn't start with a room full of people. It was a self-tape, but she came in and there was just the casting assistant there. And so it actually threw her off. Mm-hmm. She's a very young and new actress. And she's like, do they not care?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And all that stuff, because we all want to be loved.
Of course, a lot of times nowadays too, they go in for these tapings and the whole production company, including the director, is in, you know,
some other country.
Yeah. Atlanta.
Yeah,
or something.
Do you audition still or you get offered now?
I it's kind of a combination of both, but yeah, I do. I just did a film. I didn't just do it. I did it last spring, but it hasn't come out yet. But I did one. And that film, I remember I was in Toronto and they sent me the script and I looked at it and I said, well, they should offer this out because it's already, we've already done this. It was a movie with David Spade and David, I played his dad on a sitcom called,
Just Shoot Me?
No.
No. Am I thinking about that?
Rules of engagement. Yeah, rules of engagement. Yeah. Rules of engagement was on CBS. And I said, this is the exact same relationship. I said, it's a no-brainer. I know, but this director is no, he wants to just see you doing it. So, okay, so I came back to LA and they put me on tape.
Yeah, yeah.
And you booked it, and that was the film.
Yeah, we did the film. It's supposed to come out on Netflix, I think, in the spring.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's a comedy.
What's your process?
I'm hoping it'll be very funny. I have not seen the film yet. But I, when I was doing looping on it with the director, he said they tested it, not the final version, but a test version, and that it, they got a very positive response.
Do you care? Like, do you watch what you do, or you just go, I've done it and I'm moving on?
To do a comedy film.
Yeah.
I just hope it's funny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think it could be. Mm. I mean, there's several factors it depends on because you think, well, David's funny. David's kind of the straight man in it, though, in a way.
Oh, really?
Well, in a way. I mean, it's the girl. You know, it's him in a relationship with the girl, and the girl who's a lovely actress, Lauren, and she's I can't say how she is in it, but all the scenes I did with her, she was great. So I'm hoping it came out funny. Sometimes, you're doing a scene, you think it's hilarious, and you see it on film, it's not that funny. So it's going to depend on the editing and the music and all the rest of it. You know? But I'm just hoping it'll be funny because it could potentially be,
Was there ever a role that you just said, oh my God, I would kill to have this great part, great director, and it wasn't, or you did book it or you didn't, and what was?
Well, the one I can really think of that I thought, got away, but I don't really think I was ever close to it, was I was doing a play. This was in the early 80s. I think this is before soap operas, or maybe during, I kind of forget. But they're doing a miniseries in Europe called Winds of War, which I'd read the books by Herman Wouk. And anyway, it was the part of Robert Mitchum's son. He was a Navy officer, and they tested me for it. But they hired Jan Michael Vincent for it, and Ally McGraw was in it. It was a big deal back in the 80s, And I always wanted to work with Robert Mitchum. He was kind of a influence of mine, and he was someone I kind of wanted to work with. And the other two I really wanted to work with were George Scott and Gene Hackman, and I actually did get a chance to work with both of them because I did a play with George C. Scott. And then I did a movie with Gene Hackman, which both were great. Both were great.
What was the film? What was the film with Gene Hackman?
It was called Rules of Engagement.
I was like, there's so many productions called Rules of Engagement.
Well, maybe I'm mixing up the television show. Then it was called. Owen Wilson was in it. Gene Hackman.
Oh, Royal Tenenbaums?
No. It was about a Navy pilot. It was
Behind Enemy Lines.
Behind Enemy Lines. Yes. Why did I say Rules of Engagement? Behind Enemy Lines.
Rules of Engagement. It sounds like isn't there Samuel Jackson or Meg Ryan or something like that?
Wasn't it also a sitcom on CBS?
I think so.
Maybe I'm mixing it up, but it was something like that. Yeah. That's the one I did with David. I played his dad on it. Guest appearances.
Okay. Yeah.
Hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely hilarious. Which is why I think they wanted me to do the movie with.
Yeah. No. Fair enough.
Already established that I didn't play his dad in the movie. Yeah. I played his boss.
Okay. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
You seem so, and you might have changed, with wisdom and years and experience. But I've met a lot of actors, and you seem so relaxed about everything. Like, almost like, yeah, that'd be great to get that. If I don't, move on.
Yeah.
Next one. Were you always like this?
Yeah, no, I think I'm completely, in many ways, unsuited to be an actor. I don't know. It's not a mistake I got into it because I did pursue it. I had an ambition toward it. But I don't think I'm what, anyone would logically think of as an actor type person, whatever that is. I mean, there's so many different types of, because I'm
crazy.
Although a lot of very introverted,
nuts,
nuts, right? All those things, but also a very introverted inner person, which I think a lot of actors are anyway. And that's why they go into, I mean, you have the two different types, but one thing I did have that was extremely fortunate, and it had nothing to do with, complimentary toward me. It was just by nature. Was I had a very selective memory. So I could be, gearing up for something I, like you say, really wanted to get such and such a role and then not get it. And then a week or two later, I'll have completely forgotten it. I was able never to dwell on disappointments, which I think you have to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless you get very lucky very young. Yeah. You know, and suddenly everything, you know, falls into place. But in terms of the constant, for lack of a better word, rejection, it's not rejection. It's just you're not, you know, getting everything you're going up for. I was just fortunate to have, like I said, a very selective memory. And then people, you know, I just forgot about it and just moved on. So, yeah. And that's, again, it's not something I tried to have. It was just something that was my nature. And so that was lucky. That was a good trait to have as an actor.
Yeah.
You can forget, because I've known so many people, terrific actors, you know, actually actors are very, generally very sensitive people, usually the good ones, who have been, you know, devastated by the emotional hardship that it takes on someone's ego and on their, you know, on their person. And, you know, through no fault of their own, it's just very, very difficult to do. So I think if you are lucky enough to, you know, be the type of person where it doesn't affect you too much, you're just that. You're lucky.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's that dichotomy and that balance that, you know, we're always trying to have, is to be a sensitive person. We are sensitive, but to have that tough skin.
Yeah.
Which is so necessary, because like you said, I know some amazingly talented people.
Yes.
And, but in my mind, I actually think it's like their personality is not suited
for this
industry.
No, it's all wrong.
Because it is a business.
It is a business.
They're suited for the art, not the business.
And the art of, you know, acting, whether it's in the theater or on film, has nothing to do with business when you think about it. I mean, people who are very, very well suited to being performing artists are usually completely unsuited to navigating through the business of show business.
You know?
So, you got to kind of, the chips kind of fall into place for it to work in that respect.
Yeah.
Now, you have worked with one of my favorite directors on more than one occasion. Can you guess who I'm thinking of?
Well, I did Clint Eastwood.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Bob Goldthwait and I have done like 5 movies together, you know, Bob. But that was it, Bob. Yeah. How did that come about, Clint? I'm trying to think. That was Changeling is the first one I did with Clint. And, I met him on the set.
Oh, wow.
On the set as we were shooting. That's when I met him. But what happened was, I remember I went over to, I went over to Warner Brothers, and I went into audition for the role of, turned out to be Angelina Jolie's attorney. She doesn't hire him because she doesn't have any money. The character doesn't have any money. He's a pro bono attorney. He's like a crusader. And anyway, so I remember I went in to read for it, and I had to go somewhere the next day. And the casting director said to me, take a look at this scene. Clint wants to see this scene as well. And then, if you could come back tomorrow. I said, I can't come back tomorrow. I'm going to be out of town. You know?
Yeah.
I said, let me take a look at it now. So I stepped outside and went back in, as he put down. So anyway, that's how that came about. And then, like I said, I never met him. That was the end of it. Then they hired me for it. And then I met him on the set. And I remember it was the scene with John Malkovich, and Angelina was in it too. All three of us were in that first scene I did.
Not bad.
Yeah. All three of us. That's when I met all three of them. And, I remember John said to me, now we got to be, because John had done a movie with him about 20 years earlier where he played a bad guy and Clint was a Secret Service.
Oh, In the Line of Fire.
Yeah,
it's one of my favorite films.
That's right.
So good.
And anyway, John says, so we got to be ready because, you know, he likes to do 1 or 2 takes. That's it. But move on. So, you know, be prepared. You're not going to get a lot of takes.
Yeah. You're not Fincher and doing 67 takes.
That's right. And he was like that. It was very efficient.
Yeah.
Just exactly the way I like to work. So we
got me great. Too.
Yeah.
Just boom, boom.
And then the other one I did with him, with Leo DiCaprio, was about J. Edgar Hoover. And that one, I remember I got a call. They are interested in you for this part. And then I read the script and I said, what about this part? I said, because it was a part of a politician who was interrogating someone in a committee, Senate committee. And I thought, you know, I'd rather not do that. I said, what about the part of Mitchell Palmer, the attorney general under Wilson, whose house gets blown up in the picture, you know, an anarchist throws a bomb in his house.
And I go, oh, okay, you can play that role.
And that's it was just like there that? Okay,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I didn't audition. I just said, I'll play that role. And they said, okay, yeah. He said,
that's, that's amazing.
Yeah. And I much preferred it.
Yeah, know, yeah.
It turned out great. That's I remember they had to get a stunt double, and I told them at the time, I said, because the stunt was the bomb hits, and a guy has to fly out of the chair and glasses through. And I said to him, I said, I'll do the stunt. He says, you know, it's not the big deal. I'm not jumping off a building or anything.
Yeah.
I said, no, we can't. We can't.
Yeah. If you get injured, boom, boom, boom. So, yeah. We're in trouble.
So what was it like working? How was Clint as a person?
He's kind of like just how you'd think he'd be. You know what I mean? From if you watched his movie. I used to watch him on TV. You know, when I was a kid, I used to watch Rawhide.
Yeah.
So I knew him from the TV days. And what one of the things I thought was that I really appreciated about him, too, a lot of people, they don't want to talk about those early things that, you know, that they were known for. Him, no. No, we talked about, you know, the Rawhide days. He really enjoyed that, doing that TV Western, you know, before the spaghetti Westerns.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget to him. One time we were doing, I guess it was Changeling, and I was sitting in the hallway between takes. I was standing in the hallway between takes. They were lighting in the other room, big courtroom scene. And I hear this voice, Jeff. And I turn around, and it's Clint. He's sitting in a director's chair on the side of the, you know, the hallway. And he says, strangers on a train. And I said, strangers on a train. And now I'm blanking on the actor's name. And it was a Hitchcock movie from 1949, but he said, strangers on a train. And I said, no, I can't think of the actor's name, but he was talking about Robert Walker, but I named the other guy and now I can't think of his name, but he said, no. Yeah. He said, yeah, he was great. But he said, Robert Walker. I said, oh yeah. He played the psycho. And he says, that's how I hired this guy who played the killer in the movie.
Mm.
He said, that's how he reminded me of Robert Walker and Strange. Now, why he assumed I would know the Hitchcock movie from 1949, Strangers on a Train, he just did.
Yeah.
And I happen to know it. I don't know. And now it's going to try.
You're like, whew, phew.
You know this actor. I mean,
yeah.
You heard him. This,
I can look it up.
Yeah, Strangers on a Train. I don't know why I can't think of it.
Just quickly as well, Rules of Engagement was the name of the show.
It was. Okay,
it was. Good. Yeah. 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 We're all looking up Strangers on the Train.
Oh, the name is right on the tip of my tongue. It's driving me nuts. You know that happens.
Let's have a look. And it's the killer where?
There's Farley Granger.
Farley Granger. So he says to me, Strangers on the Train. I go, Farley Granger? He says, yeah, but Robert Walker. Robert Edward. That's why I hired this guy.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's so cool. What was it like working with Leo? Did you work with
Leo? Was funny. Yeah. I mean, it was great.
Because he was still
was great.
Like, he was big, but, you know, he was still, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
was he Leo at that time?
Yes.
Still?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, yeah. But I'll tell you the funny thing about that is that when we met on the set, when Leo on the set, when our first scene together, he came up to me and says, I finally meet you, who played the father of my good buddy. Because when I had done this show with Ron Levitt.
That was Leonardo DiCaprio.
Leonardo DiCaprio,
said that to you.
Because his good buddy was Kevin Connolly, who played my son on Unhappily Ever After.
Ah.
And they were like the posse.
Yeah.
This was before Kevin did
Entourage. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He was doing Entourage at the time.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, we did the TV series before.
Yeah.
And Leo and Kevin and I guess a whole bunch of them, Toby McGuire, they all knew each other as teenagers.
Yeah.
You know, when they first came to Hollywood. And he says, I finally meet you. You play the dad of my good buddy, Kevin. He said,
yeah. That's awesome. That's a nice welcome.
Yes. Yeah. No, he was very nice young man.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we had fun with that.
Shall we wrap it up?
Yeah, let's wrap it up.
Jeff, it's been awesome.
Is there anything really you'd like to add?
Is there anything? Yeah, anything?
No, I mean, you know, I remember Jay saying to me, Jay Moore, when we did the podcast, he said, anything you want to plug? I said, no. But I already plugged the one thing I got coming out.
That's true.
Movie with David Spade.
What's it called?
Well, do you know?
It's called, well, it was called The Wrong Missy.
The Wrong Missy. All right, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's on Netflix. Do you know when it comes out?
Well, I know it's finished, but last I heard, it's going to come out in the spring.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Nice.
Well, we'll keep our eyes out for that.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for
my pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Like,
good luck with the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Anything else in your careers?
Thank you.
I greatly appreciate it. And you too.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Okay. Cheers, buddy. Thank you.
Bye.